Hello, this is Terrence McNally. We're still fighting the last battles of the Civil War, according to attorney Connie Rice in a recent interview. Rice has for decades been doing the hard work of police reform and has had her share of success. She believes there's a war within American policing. Does it continue to go with the policing that descended from slavery, which is containment suppression? Or do they go toward community healing, wraparound safety, public health policing, which doesn't even promote cops for making arrests? Here's my 2012 conversation with Rice about her book Power Concedes Nothing and her work to change the Los Angeles Police Department, starting with lawsuits and ultimately working on the inside with former Chief Charlie Beck.
Today's guest, Connie Rice, has taken on school and bus systems, death row, the states of Mississippi and California, and the Los Angeles Police Department, and won, not just in court, but also on the streets and prisons, where she has spearheaded campaigns to reduce gang violence. She has long been dedicated, in her words, to finishing what Martin Luther King Jr. started, and she pursues that aim with a focused passion, intelligence, and commitment. Rice has been called the conscience of Los Angeles, though she gives that title to Erwin Chemerinsky. And she has recently published a memoir of her life and her work to this point, Power Concedes Nothing, One Woman's Quest for Social Justice in America, From the Courtroom to the Kill Zones. Now, often my first question, if you listen to the show, you know this, I ask my guests to tell us briefly about their path to the work that they do today. Mention mentors, models, turning points, moments of decision. But that's her book, not the brief answer to the first question. So what I want Connie to do is tell the story of that book, her journey, the journey of the police and the sheriffs and the journey of the community. Too often, when we look nowadays, we see problems not being solved, solutions not being found or implemented, money, lives, and moments of opportunity being wasted. So Connie Rice starts out suing a particular model of law enforcement that had held Los Angeles in thrall for decades. In response, the model begins to shift. So then she works with and finally within LA law enforcement, and the model shifts some more. That kind of story just doesn't happen often enough. That story calls for the right balance of opposition and cooperation, and in the right sequence, and the strategic use of the tools available, the ability to shift from litigation to collaboration, and the ability of law enforcement to shift and meet her. Too often, we get caught up in opposing each other rather than looking for every opportunity to align on solving a problem. We need to learn all we can from this relationship and its success and its positive effect so far on millions of citizens of Los Angeles and beyond. On Freeform, we explore the lives, the work, the ideas of individuals that I suspect have pieces of the puzzle of a world that just might work. We look at new, innovative, provocative approaches to business, environment, health, science, politics, media, all based on the fact that I believe we can do better and I want to find out how. In her legal work, Connie Rice has led multiracial coalitions of lawyers and clients to win more than $10 billion in damages and policy changes through traditional class action civil rights cases, redressing police misconduct, race and sex discrimination, unfair public policy in transportation, probation, public housing. At the invitation of LAPD Chief William Bratton, Connie investigated the Rampart scandal and obtained the commitment of the chief to reform LAPD's training and incentives through an internal commission that she now co-chairs. Prior to co-founding the Advancement Project, Connie was co-director of the Los Angeles Office of the NAACP Legal Defense and Education Fund, an associate at the law firm of Morrison & Forster, and a clerk to the Honorable Damon Keith, judge of the United States Court of Appeals, Sixth Circuit. She's a graduate of Harvard College and the New York University School of Law. Welcome, Connie Rice, to KPFK and Freeform.
Great to be here, Terrence. Thank you.
Yes. Here's that first question, which is, since I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the work and the ideas that we talk about, could you briefly talk about, but in this case, your path up to maybe the point at which you move to L.A. and start working in L.A. Your path, because this is a memoir, and I found the early stuff about who you are and how you were brought up and how, I mean, when someone is as singularly dedicated as you do, the roots go pretty far back.
Yeah, it's a family tradition. We're driven, and it's a family culture of achievement. And if anybody looks like they're having fun, there's something wrong. So.
And I heard when in Karen Grigsby Bates' story about you in this book on NPR, she says that she spoke to Condi, your cousin Condoleezza, who said, you're more driven than she is. You and know, she was Secretary of State.
Well, that's debatable. Yeah, we're both kind of OCD driven. Yeah, it comes with the territory. I come from two families. One was more working class, one was more privileged. Meaning that when my dad's side of the family got out of slavery, and I am just four generations from slavery, if you think about it, my great-grandparents were slaves. They were 11 and 12 and 13 when they were freed, which is pretty amazing when you think about it. The five, as I say in the book, we went from legal chattel to legal counsel in four generations. It's quite a saga in and of itself. But coming from a family that came out of slavery, on one side of the family, literate.
That's right. Key
owning,
point.
Yeah,
key
literate, point. Because our owners were folks who love books. Our white owners, my owner ancestors, as I call them, they prided themselves on their books. There's actually a letter from one of the matriarchs of my slave-owning side of the family, and she said, "We shall never be known by the size of our landholds. We shall be known by the size of our libraries." And they would read Shakespeare to one another. The Heads, Julia Head is the great-grandmother that Condi and I both share. We share a maternal grandmother, at least. We might share a paternal grandfather. That's not quite clear. but our maternal grandmother grew up. In fact, she was offered an education in France because she was the love child of one of the brothers of the slave owners. And anyway, so it's not exactly gone with the wind, but we do come from the Sally Hemings branch of slavery. And when you come out of slavery from the more privileged end of it, on the food chain, the post-slavery food train, we were pretty high up. So to preserve that advantage of being, of having white slave-owning blood and therefore being literate and giving and being house slaves as opposed to field slaves, we were already in a white dominant culture and a European dominance culture. We were at the top of that food chain, which is where part of our advantage began. And from there, you to keep that, to lock those advantages in, you've got to be able to read, write, and speak better than everybody else. That's the only power that you have in a post-civil rights Jim Crow America, to lock in the advantages and not lose any more than you already had after slavery ended. So I think that's where the culture got rooted. And so with a family that says, brings up every kid. By the time I was two and a half, my first word was mom, my second word was dad, and my third word was college, and I knew I was going. And so that's where the culture comes from. Yeah, we're driven. Yeah, we achieve a lot. We're a little bit like Ma and Pa Kettle. There's actually a picture, if you go to the website for the book, www.powerconceitsnothing.com, you'll see the pictures of my ancestors, and there's one of Julia Head and John Wesley Rice, that picture says it all. That stern look in their eyes, that's the Rices, and that's where I come from.
Yeah, and then your father was military, a career in the Air Force. And I'm going to read this because it's so concise. Despite his reserve, we learn the soldier's way by reading between his actions. Life is serious business. Selfless dedication is its own reward. Do the right thing. Failure is not an option. Integrity is all. Stand and deliver. These were not slogans he ever uttered, just principles he lives.
Yep, and we pick them right up. Yeah. I'll tell you, the gang member, Bo Taylor, a former gang member and gang intervention expert who died a few years ago, and who is one of my teachers, one of my Sherpas, my street Sherpas, introduced me one time, and it was great affection, and he said, "Connie's a soldier." And it's because my dad's a soldier.
And then you say, also, without robbing us of our childhood or individuality, our parents had managed to equip us with humane values, purpose, and a Trojan work ethic. Their gift, the love and devotion that molded us into secure, creative, giving human beings, was the greatest legacy a parent can leave a child. And you have gone, and your brothers, your siblings as well, right?
That's right. I have two brothers. They're both younger. They're both doctors. They're both doctors. And so, yeah, I my parents did an incredible. Don't forget, we moved every year. We moved 17 times in 22 years, and yet we didn't lose our minds. We didn't become drug addicts. We didn't lose our way. In fact, it helped us find our way because we had to stay so close. And we're nomads, basically.
Yeah. My dad worked for the VA rather than the military, but it meant every time to get a promotion meant you moved.
Exactly.
So I moved, I don't know, first, third, fifth, sixth, eighth, tenth grade.
And what that does is it frees you because you don't need the approval of peers. So you're not dependent on your peers. No one dared to bully us. I don't even remember anybody. And you learn to go into a place, assess it very quickly, and figure out how it worked. And you learned, you learned who was who and what was what, and you learned how to pull the levers to get stuff done. And so it ended up being a great education.
And it also means every time you're in the new school, the new class, the new whatever, you have to strike out.
That's right.
And you
break
know
the ice.
Those who can't, that must be very, very tough. But those who can, they learn to become masters of that.
That's right. You master your environment very quickly and you move on. You also don't get too attached to place. But anyway, I had a great
break. Let me tell people, I'm Terrence McNally, speaking with Connie Rice, civil rights attorney and author of Power Concedes Nothing, subtitled One Woman's Quest for Social Justice in America from the Courtroom to the Kill Zones. You can learn more at advancementproject.org. Her organization, and at Power Concedes Nothing, one word, powerconcedesnothing.com, the book's website. This is Freeform on KPFK 90.7 FM, 98.7 in Santa Barbara, streaming and podcasting at kpfk.org. And you can visit me at terrencemcnally.net, TerrenceMcNally.net, or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same website to learn more about the show, guests, podcasts, transcripts. You can listen to the podcast there or at iTunes. You can sign up there at iTunes to have it delivered to you weekly. You can sign up there or by emailing me at temcnally@mac.com to get a weekly announcement telling you who's going to be on and what we're going to talk about. Connie.
Well, great upbringing, great parents, great family. And so why shouldn't I have to give back? I don't know. I've always felt like I stood on the shoulders of some very important people and that I owed a lot of folks. I mean, think about it. If we hadn't had the abolitionists, if we hadn't had the Tuskegee Airmen, if we hadn't had the Pullman Porters, we haven't had Fannie Lou Hamer or the suffragists, the women's rights, where would we be? If you think about what Harriet Tubman had to do.
Yeah.
In her time, she couldn't see the end of slavery. But she could rescue one slave at a time. So she did what she could. She created an underground railroad, and she knew that the end of slavery would come one day. Now today, we've got a new kind of slavery that we've got to fight and get organized to fight because as the great-granddaughter of slaves, I really, really can't abide the fact that we've got child sex slaves in L.A. County and that it's ballooning as an industry. So that's sort of what the future holds. But when I left home and went to college, I didn't know I was going to
Harvard. I do want to take you to the story that you opened the book with,
right?
And the story that when I saw you speak recently opened with, which is the What Is You story.
All right. In seventh grade, I grew up in the Air Force, which is like a bubble. You go from Air Force Base to Air Force Base, or you live in these wonderful cities in Japan and Europe. So it was a very sheltered sheltered life, and I didn't understand my own privilege. And the first time I understood my own privilege was on the campus of Dysart Junior High School outside of Phoenix as Luke Air Force Base in Arizona. And I, of course, arrived in buses to this local junior high school campus. Only the Air Force kids went to school, we went to school, in air-conditioned brick buildings that had lockers. We had books. We had a cafeteria. The local children, who were migrant workers' children, they were African-American and Mexican-American. They were the children of the harvest. They went to school in portable trailers that were not air-conditioned. They had no lockers, and they sat at outside picnic tables with no cafeteria, separate and unequal on the same campus. And I didn't even think about it. Seventh grade. This little kid who was an African-American migrant worker's kid, he's very, very dark-skinned, and he marched right across that gully that separated our two sides of the campus and climbed up on the platform, and he stood right in front of me, and he just stopped me in my tracks, and he said, "What is you? What is you? And he had been trying to figure out what I was, because he could see I wasn't white. But because I'm light-skinned, he couldn't figure out that I was black. I didn't look like the black people in his world. And so I said, I was stunned, and all this stuff's going through my head, and I describe this in the book. But finally he blurts out, "Is you Japanese?" And I was stunned. I said, how could he possibly think that I'm Japanese? I mean, clearly I'm African-American. What is with this kid? And then I said, no, I'm black. I'm black just like you. And he says, no, you ain't. And he walked right off. And you want to know something? He was right. I was not black like him. I may have been African-American, but I was African-American royalty. He was a migrant worker's kid. I was light-skinned. He was dark-skinned. I spoke the king's English. He spoke Ebonics. We were not black like each other. However, I needed to learn from him. And so I found him again. Long story short, I went to his house. It was a shack, a tin shack. They barely had electricity. They had one electrical outlet that was as dangerous as all get out. They had no bathrooms. They had no plumbing, indoor plumbing. And he had no place to study. And every day after class, he would go to the fields. And I remember walking to his house with him. I met him after school, and I said, "Where are your books?" He says, "I ain't got none." I said, "Well, how do you do your homework?" "I ain't got none." They didn't intend for him to be anything but a farm worker, and so they didn't give him any homework. That was number one, the first time I realized that within the black community, there was relative privilege, and I was still at the top of the food chain. You know, 100 years after slavery, I was still at the top of the food chain. And it also made me realize that I had to advocate for him. So I went to the teacher the next day after I visited this little kid's house, and I said, I want my friend to have a lunch counter and I want a cafeteria, and I want my friend to have air conditioning, and I want my friend to have lockers. How do we do that? And she told me, "You don't need to worry about those children. They're happy the way they are." And I got furious. It was the first time that I yelled at a teacher and stood down power. And so that was sort of my awakening.
Yeah. And if you would just, because there's one other I want you to share, was Robert Peabody, who you said was your first client.
Yeah, he really was my first client. We were getting ready to go to London, so the first half of second grade was spent in North Carolina. We left North Carolina to go to D.C. so my parents could both go to spy school, because that's what they did when they were overseas. They were both spies. But I had to finish first grade, and I did it at an all-African-American school in Anacostia in Washington. And the first day I arrived, there was this little kid. He couldn't even make it up the stairs, and he just grabbed onto me because he was being bullied. And I ended up being his guardian. He had kidney disease, and his kidneys were gone, and he just reeked of urine all the time. And everybody made fun of him, and he had this unforgivable last name of Peabody, so you know how cruel the kids were.
Oh, my God.
So I ended up I would sit next to him. We had these double desks with the inkwells and, you know, the old 19th century desks. And I would sit with him. I would escort him in the playground. I wouldn't let anybody bully him. He would just wait for me at the gate every day, and then I would deliver him to his mother. And just because he grabbed onto my arm the first day of school,
right. Or
the first day that we came to school after the Christmas break, I ended up being his protection. And as the one day I came and he wasn't at the gate, and it was he just never came back. And so I just blocked him out of my head. And he probably died. I don't really know, but I think he died. And I just kind of blocked him out. And I said, okay, got to move on and just focus on getting straight A's, and just kind of blocked him out. But he really was my first client. I protected him and I represented him, and I wouldn't let anybody hurt him.
And that was first grade?
This was the second half of first grade.
Yeah.
I was seven.
There was something in you already.
Well, it's my mother's compassion. My mother's compassion, and neither parent, my mother and my father, they hated bullies. They would not put up with a bully. Do not bully my parents or you will have a fight on your hands. So I come by it naturally.
Okay. Another time I think before college, I want one more incident. Barbara Jordan speaks at the Watergate.
This was 11th grade. I guess it was the summer of 73. Maybe it was 72. I can't remember. But Shaker Heights High School, 11th grade. We were getting ready to move to Texas. And this would have been my third high school coming up. My mother was just, she's a master teacher, and you don't get any rest over the summer. Don't forget about summer vacation. She had us on swim team and chess team, and we had to practice our piano. And then at night, we would have to write essays. And by then, we would die for school to begin so we could get a rest. You know, my mother was just manic. And so I begged her. I said, Mom, just let me watch these hearings. These are the Watergate hearings. This is going to be a huge smackdown of this arrogant president. And I was already a political junkie, so by this is age 16. I said, just no swim team, Mom. I don't want to do swim team. I don't want to do any of that stuff. Just let me watch it. I promise I'll do the ironing. And she knew when I promised to do it, because I hate ironing. I hate any kind of housework. And so she says, okay, you do the ironing and I'll let you watch these hearings. I was in heaven. So I'm down in the basement with this ironing board and this iron. I don't even know how to iron, but I was watching gavel to gavel coverage of the Watergate hearings. And during that, I was like, the first 5 days go by, and, you know, we learn about Butterfield and the tapes and all this. And the one day I got transfixed was the day that I heard this female voice in this alto, this basso alto, and she says, Mr. Chairman, may the gentle lady from Texas be recognized. And I mean, I thought, who is this? And then she proceeded to just lay everybody to waste with her cross-examination and her enunciation and her verbal acuity and her the marshalling of her ideas. And when she gave her finale speech, I was transfixed. To the point where I burned a hole right through my dad's shirt and through the ironing board cover. I had just let the iron sit there. I had ruined everything, but I didn't care. I had heard Barbara Jordan, and I knew exactly what I had to be.
Yeah, that's funny. If this were the MOW, the movie of Connie Rice, they'd do that, and they'd say, no one will believe that really happened. But you say about that, I had just seen a Praetorian Guard of Freedom in Action, and my life's direction was set. So what was that life direction was set? You're a junior in high school.
Well, I knew about achievement, but what was I achieving for? And I really didn't know. I just knew that I was going to college. But beyond that, here's what I knew. I wasn't particularly moved by romance. That you could live without that quite easily. It's overrated. I wasn't particularly moved by fame. I don't, you know, that seemed kind of shallow and empty, which, of course, is the only thing that counts these days. So celebrity and fame didn't mean anything. Money didn't mean anything to me. It was just a means to an end. So what was going to drive me? And it's the same thing. What's all this for? And so one really I realized what made me tick. It was doing justice. It was, you know, the reason a five-year-old when I was five, I wanted to free the lion out of the cage. It was why I defended Robert Peabody. It was why I wanted to argue for the migrant workers' kids. I was kind of hardwired for it, and I finally realized, okay, it's the drum major for justice. It's the trumpet of conscience. That's what I hear.
Okay, we'll take you to college in just a second. I'm Terrence McNally, and I'm speaking with Connie Rice, civil rights attorney, author of Power Concedes Nothing, One Woman's Quest for Social Justice in America from the Courtroom to the Kill Zones. You can learn more at advancementproject.org and powerconcedesnothing.com. So you go to Harvard.
By mistake. I must have been the only kid there who didn't know where she was going. I wanted to go to Northwestern because I thought I was going to be a broadcast journalist. And I didn't know it at the time because I was so in love with what had happened with Woodward and Bernstein. And I loved Walter Cronkite. My mom didn't let us watch a lot of TV, but we always watched the news. And I love newscasters. So I thought I was going to be one and wanted to go to Northwestern. My dad had another idea. I think he thought I was going to marry a Harvard man. That didn't quite work out. But since he was paying for it, and I got into Harvard. I got into everywhere I applied, and I ended up there. And I thought, well.
And when you say by mistake, it's because you thought you were filling out a Radcliffe.
Right. Because at the time, women didn't apply to Harvard. Women couldn't go to Harvard. You had to go through the women's portal, which was Radcliffe College. And I thought, well, at least it's a women's school. And I end up at the bastion of male power, Harvard University. But I learned how to deal with it. I got a great education there, and I learned what the title of this book is, which is that power really doesn't concede a thing without a huge demand and a concerted effort to make that demand real. And so I majored in government. I studied power, different systems of power, different ways that different modes of democracy. I studied slavery from Orlando Patterson, who was a conservative guy but knows a lot about American slavery, meaning both Latin American and South American and North American slavery and Caribbean slavery. And so I got a great education from Harvard. And I also learned, more importantly, the informal, the fly clubs and the social networks of power. The notice every president either comes from Harvard or Yale.
Yeah.
We have a kind of oligarchy in this country, and it comes from those power factories, Yale, Harvard.
I mean, if it's Romney against Obama, it's again.
It's Harvard.
Harvard and Harvard, right.
Harvard and Harvard. So
as it is in this interview.
Exactly. Yeah. So, you know, if you understand how power works, you understand what you can and can't do with it. Timing's everything. Just as Harriet Tubman couldn't see the end of slavery, she could see what she could do during slavery's time to take its edge off and to sink it and to start chipping away at its floor so that it falls through. So you got to know where you are. You have to understand how to assess big systems. If you're a systems person, I mean, the trick, I think the main thing I've learned is that if you understand who you are, you can figure out what kind of work you do, what kind of work you're good at. I'm not good one-on-one. I'm good with systems. I'm good looking at the bigger picture. It's not daunting to me. I like trying to figure out how you change.
You're at home
policy.
In that.
Yes, I'm very.
I mean, it's interesting. The next quote that I had coming up here was, "Ending extreme poverty and racial exclusion could not be done with lawsuits alone. It also required a revolution in values and the political will to restructure our political and economic systems." And that's really, in other words, as much as you've worked as a lawyer and as much as you've won lawsuits, they're always about changing systems, aren't they, as much
that's
as possible?
Right. That's right. And Martin Luther King said the exact same thing, and basically carrying out his agenda. Martin Luther King said the same. He says, the civil rights revolution will not be won in courtrooms, although we will need those arenas. And so you can get a lot done with a lawsuit. And the reason that I could go as far as I have playing the inside-outside power games is because I won in court, and the lawsuits will always be necessary. So it's not about leaving litigation. It's about what do you do after you've won the case. And to figure out what you do after you've won the case, you actually have to engineer the solution so that it takes root. What you're after is you're after changing the DNA of a bureaucracy that affects the lives of poor people. And what you're after is to give your clients, the organized leadership of invisible LA and poor LA, giving them the tools to end their own poverty, giving them the tools so that they can actually manipulate the political system in the same way that my friends do. So you're doing Robin Hood, you're doing jujitsu, you're trying to give the folks who are on the outside a seat at the table, and so that they can argue for themselves. They don't need me to argue for them, but my job is to open these systems up to them so that they can get in and demand what they need for themselves and to end their own poverty. If you give people a ladder, they will climb out. If you give them the tools, they will end their own poverty.
And if you give them a door,
they will walk through it.
They will walk through it. One of the things I said in my intro, yeah, was that for you to both be a tough and I mean, as I said, you've won $10 billion both in awards and in changes to systems and so on, and then be able to work with the same people, essentially, that you have fought in court, it calls something in you and something in them. What do you think that is about you? I would imagine part of it is that your eye is actually on the prize that we were just discussing, the change of the system rather than the victory in
right.
the lawsuit.
Right. Are you trying to make a point or are you trying to make a real difference? If it's about your ego, you'll be trying to make a point. If it's about what kind of progress can you make in this situation, what kind of deal can you cut? Because sometimes it is about cutting deals. Other times it's about going to the mat. Because there's no deal to make. But you don't give away $4 billion in improvements to the bus system just to make a point. That's when you bargain. That's when you bargain. You've got to know when to fold them. You've got to know when to hold them. And I've learned when it's worth it. And the clients will tell you when it's worth it. Yeah, if we can get this stopped and we can get $500 million into the bus system, the bus riders union had to make this call, with the bus riders case.
I do want to talk just a bit great. About that because I remember when that took off, that seemed to me to be a really innovative approach. To actually look at improvements to the LA public transportation system as a civil rights issue. Was that as innovative as it looked to me?
No, it wasn't that innovative because Martin Luther King wrote about transportation as a civil right. When he died, he was going after economic rights. And when he died, we had barely dismantled Jim Crow. We had ended American apartheid. So we had ended brutality, but we hadn't realized equality. The second phase of the Civil Rights Revolution was realizing equality. And that meant what he called, this is a quote from him, quote, radical restructuring of our economic and political systems. Now,
and radical, by the way, if people realize, comes from root, which means not way out. It means at the root. It means
right.
The system, not just the symptoms.
That's right. And so what he was talking about was not, he wasn't talking about going to communism or socialism, although we have a social democratic system in this country, believe it or not. He was talking about re-engineering the values. In other words, if you put human beings first and you reorganize your economic priorities, it's not about Wall Street bonuses that drive your entire financial system, the financial part of the financial sector of your economy. It becomes, yes, okay, so there's creative destruction with capitalism. We all know that. But when the destruction happens, it doesn't destroy people's lives. It means that you don't lose your medical benefits just because your job ends. It means that you don't have the job training money cut off. It means that it actually increases. It means that you won't lose your house because you've lost a job because a company has to shut down. It means that you will be able to move on to the next phase, and we will help you figure out what that is. That's what a human-centered capitalism does. There's a much more robust safety net. Instead, for the last 35 years, we've dismantled the safety net. We've ended the job training. We've cut back on all kinds of public benefits that allow people to have a bridge into the next job when they've lost their last job. We've cut back on the public sector in a way that's very unhealthy. So we haven't invested in those systems. In fact, we've dismantled them.
You know, I recall interviewing Robert Reich on his book Super Capitalism, and he was saying that the 50s and early 60s were the almost golden age. In other words, the time at which we were just fighting for civil rights, we actually had a social democratic system with a safety net.
Yeah, we were headed in that direction, and we seem to have locked those values in. But
we had contending – labor had power. There was contending interests, and it was also the time that people did best. The average person's living wage has gone down since 73.
Absolutely, and in absolute terms as well as relative terms.
Yeah.
And the other thing is that back in those days, and Paul Krugman writes about this, is that there was a corporate culture of responsibility. There actually was a corporate culture of responsibility. There were CEOs that took more than 17 times the amount of money that their lowest paid worker got. They couldn't bear it. No company did that. And today, it's just robber baron time. We've got the ethos of Ayn Rand, which is greed is good. And we've gone away from Martin Luther King's vision, which is shared prosperity. There is no vision for shared prosperity. There's a choice now. There's a choice. The debate that we're having is between Ayn Rand and Martin Luther King Jr. is really what we're having. And
yeah.
we better decide which set of values we want.
Well, we know which one has been trumping
right.
everyone for the last few years. I'm Terrence McNally. We're at the halfway point. I'm speaking with Connie Rice, civil rights attorney, author of Power Concedes Nothing. This is a memoir of her life and her work up to this point, subtitled One Woman's Quest for Social Justice in America from the Courtroom to the Kill Zones. And you can learn more at Advancement Project, one word, advancementproject.org, and powerconcedesnothing.com.
Hello, this is Terrence McNally. You're listening to my 2012 conversation with Connie Rice about her book, Power Concedes Nothing, and her work for decades to change the Los Angeles Police Department, starting with lawsuits and ultimately working on the inside with former Chief Charlie Beck.
Let's go now to your experience with the gangs. In what we've just been talking about, we've sort of been saying, okay, for the average person, for a normal family in America, the system. Now we're talking about a dark spot way outside of that, which is the kill zones and the life that the families went through there. Tell us about the day you meet both with the women of Jordan Downs and their men.
Yes, Mercedes Marquez called me and she said, look, Latino residents in Jordan Downs are getting rototilled, Connie. We got to go down there and help them. And I left court I'd never been to the African-American-dominated housing projects, which are Jordan Downs and Imperial Courts and Nickerson Gardens. This is the early 90s, and so African-Americans were still the majority, both in Watts and in those housing projects, but it was quickly changing. We were in the middle of that change. And today, of course, those housing projects are close to 70% Latino. Now, I went down there to meet for the first time the African-American residents and to kind of see what was possible in terms of integrating Latino, newly arrived Latino residents of housing projects. I arrive outside the Grape Street Gym, and I arrive in my tin can of a car. I had this little dented Honda Civic hatchback. It was pathetic. And I had left federal court, so I was in this St. John's suit with more pearls than Barbara Bush because I was before a Republican judge, and it helps, you know, if you look like a Republican woman if you're before a Republican judge. So I looked ridiculous. I had these Ferragamo pumps and this briefcase, and I go into the Grape Street Gym where all these women are, and they cussed us to a fare thee well. They just blessed us out because we had abandoned them, and they had been suffering through a war zone. It was the middle of the crack wars, and these were women who had to put their kids to bed in bathtubs because the bullets would come flying through the drywall and through the windows. They couldn't keep their windows. There was so much gunfire. So it was really a war zone in our own backyard, and I wasn't even aware of it. And they should have cussed us out for leaving them there in those conditions. And finally, after the guy said, well, you're absolutely right, we've abandoned you and you should be angry with us, I can stay or I can leave. Is there something I can do to help, or do you want me to go? And they said, help our men. Help our men cut the violence, Connie. Go back there and help them with the truce. I said, what truce? I had no idea what the truce was. I didn't even know who the gangs were. I didn't know anything. They said, they're doing a truce and they're trying to figure out how to carry it out. Go help them. They're in the back of Markham Junior High School in the trailer. I go back there. Long story short, I knock on the door. Remember, St. John's suit and pearls, knocking on the door of the gangster confab, a gangster conference. They open the door, and there's this wall-to-wall gangsters with the bandanas, the colors of their gang. So you had one side of the room of these burly ex-convict guys with blue bandanas, meaning Grape Street Crips. And on the other side was the red bandanas, which were the bounty blood hunter, you know, the blood bounty hunters from Nickerson. And I must have looked like E.T., and I stupidly say to them, hi, my name's Connie Rice, I'm a legal defense fund lawyer, and I'm here to help you. And they slammed the door in my face, as they should have. And I waited for a second because I could hear them talking, and then they opened the door back up, and this guy with this wife-beater T-shirt and pants hanging down below his waist and down below his hips, and I just looked at him, and he says, you a lawyer? You say you're a lawyer? I said, yeah, I'm a lawyer. Can you get us... Yeah, there's something you can do. Can you get us that agreement between the Jews and the Arabs? I stupidly say, are you referring to the Egyptian Sinai Peace Accords? And he says, yeah, that one.
Yeah.
You know, what was I saying? You know, what an idiot I was. So I bring them that treaty, and that begins a little bit of marginal help for carrying out the truce, and I would stand on the sidelines while they did midnight basketball. This was the first time that the Crips, who were fighting over drug territory and creating all this havoc and mayhem for the women and children in those neighborhoods, this was the first time that they had ever hammered out a truce between two rival gangs. And they were doing everything they could to carry it out. Now, these weren't angels. Half of them were doing it so that they could make more money in the drug trade. The other half were afraid because their kids were now in the gangs. It wasn't altruism here. You know, these were self-interested men, except for a few who had really regretted the killing and the beating up of people and the terrorizing of the neighborhoods that they had done as members of the gang. And those men were the gang interventionists. They had stepped out of the gang. They had stopped banging. And they had kind of dedicated themselves. And so I linked up with the gang intervention guys. Fred Williams was the first one with Common Ground Foundation in Watts. And he said, look, you're going to need somebody to help you because you don't have a clue. And I said, you're absolutely right. So I just followed him around. I saw what he did. I learned the different, you know, corners and who owned what. And he was my Sherpa to the streets. And he taught me gang intervention and the tight ropes that you have to walk between the gang and the cops, the gang and the community, the gang and the schools, the gang and the church, the neighborhood church. And I learned all of those systems by following Fred. So that was my introduction to the gangs and to the streets, the black gangs, only the black gangs, and only in Watts. And so I decided to stick with those streets because I was learning things that no case was ever going to teach me. And I was learning the DNA of some of the most beleaguered and targeted communities. What we were doing in these communities and what we still do in these communities is, number one, we've written them out of the economic script. They're not even in the economic forecast. If you ask Milken or you ask the Kaiser form, if you ask them where my clients are from underclass LA, they will tell you they're not in the formulas. They're not in the forecasts. They assume that those communities will never, ever be in the mainstream economy. They will always be in the underground economy or they will be in prison. So we don't count them. We don't put them in our formulas. We don't put them in our forecasts because they're not supposed to be there. So
that's a certain percentage that's written off and will stay written off.
It will stay written off.
And so we'll deal with the rest and there'll be ups and downs, but that's just out there.
Bottom 10% are not to be included. And once you understand that, you realize, okay, so what have we done? We've decided that mass incarceration is our answer. Since they're not really going to be included in mainstream economics, they're never ever going to have jobs, we don't need to educate them, we just need to build prisons. And that's exactly what we've done. Anytime you see two-thirds of a male population going to prison,
now,
that's a mass incarceration.
Two-thirds is the percentage in these neighborhoods?
Yes. In underclass black L.A., at that time, when I went to Nickerson, Imperial, and Jordan Downs housing projects, when I realized that two-thirds, between 60 and 70% of the men had either been in state prison or were on their way to state prison, or the boys were on their way to the juvenile camps, which we still run. L.A. County has more child prisons than any other area in the country. So it becomes very clear what our answer is. It's mass incarceration. And everybody needs to read, is Michelle Alexander's book, The New Jim Crow, because it tells you how our mass incarceration juggernaut has created a gulag that has created the new Jim Crow. The same exclusions that kept my grandparents from voting and renting a house and participating in any kind of a system in this country is now being applied to ex-convicts, to former convicts. And so that's why she calls it the new Jim Crow.
Yeah.
And we need to understand that when you have a mass policy like that, you need to understand what it creates. You need to understand what its real purpose is. Now, you can't tell me that two-thirds of a male population of any group, any human group, is destined for prison. It's either because of a direct policy that has written them out of the script. Not to say that there isn't criminal activity, and not to say that certain. Look, 5% of that population needs to go away forever because they're violent and they're dangerous. I'm not talking about the 5% that's got to go away. I'm talking about 70% incarceration. Anytime you see that, you either believe in a crime gene or there's a mass incarceration strategy. And all of your systems are calibrated to produce a pipeline into prison.
Now, let me ask you, when you say a mass incarceration strategy, I think of the war on drugs as one of the ways that – one of the things that functions well within that. But it always seems to me – it never seemed quite as calculated as all that.
It isn't.
Like correctional unions want more prisons because that's more jobs and more pensions.
It's autopilot.
They are what – they are always within the top three donors in California elections, the corrections.
Absolutely. Top two. Yeah. So absolutely. It's more autopilot. It's not like there's some mass conspiracy to say we're going to annihilate these people. What you end up saying is – okay, the schools aren't going to work. You automatically push these kids out. Where you push them out is to the alternative schools. The alternative schools are an open door into the local prisons. Once a juvenile has a juvenile record, the police already know about it. They've got cards on them. They follow them around. And for the drug war, for example, middle-class folks use drugs. They can afford to pay for them. You know, my friends are the ones snorting cocaine and so forth. But we do it behind closed doors. The drug trade in these communities, these poor communities, is outside. So it's more out in the open. And the cops go for the low-hanging fruit. They're also not going to go after politically connected folks who are middle class and who vote and who make contributions because it's harder to go after them in a lot of ways. Number one, they're not out there on the corner. Number two, they're politically insulated. They've got friends. And they're part of the mainstream, so you don't want to go after them. So it's a lot of default systems. It's kind of like the default system in a software program. It automatically tips that way. Yeah. So I'm not suggesting
And then there are feedback loops.
That reinforce it.
That reinforce it. So,
absolutely.
Once you've got it, once you've got that that train running, right, it continues to keep picking up speed and adding cars.
That's right. And most people in these neighborhoods don't deal drugs. They're not violent. They don't carry guns, and they don't belong to gangs. They get up every day. They work 3 and 4 and 5 jobs, or they're doing some kind of underground economic activity that doesn't involve it's basically unregulated activity, and they're just making ends meet. But my point is, if you gave those neighborhoods the same basic amenities that my neighborhood has, you wouldn't need to lock up 70% of the men. And that my book is about the price that's paid, not just by the community members who see their fathers and their sons and their brothers all going to prison, but it's paid by us as well in the middle class. We in the middle class need to understand that our safety can no longer depend on their unsafety, that their suppression containment policing has got to stop, and the mass incarceration pipeline, the grease skid into the abattoir of the prisons, has got to stop. Why? Because when you take the men out of a community, that community dies. You take the women out of a community and that civilization dies. We have removed too many adults. It creates the boomerang that mass incarceration does to destroy the fabric of these families and to destroy the fabric of the community. And what happens then? The community becomes so disintegrated that even more threats move in, like the cartels. The reason that this book has General Stanley McChrystal's endorsement on the back and Condoleezza Rice, my former, my cousin and former Secretary of State, is because I'm writing about the transnational threat that we're nesting in our kill zones, our gang zones. Where you have areas in L.A. where there are 6,000 unsolved murders, that tells the criminal syndicates, be they the Mexican mafia behind prison bars, be it the cartels from Central America and Mexico, or be it from the Yakuza or the Russian mob or the Armenian mob. All of that organized crime knows that it can move into our invisible L.A. areas. They can move sex slavery traffic, they can move drugs, they can cow those populations. Why? Because those populations are in kill zones. They know that the police won't help them. They know that you and I won't help them. So they become victim. And guess what? When those agencies, those agents of organized crime take over our street gangs and take over these invisible pockets in LA, you want to know what we're on the road to? We're going to on the road to where Italy went. I call it the road to Palermo.
Ah, yes.
The road to Palermo. And when you have the road to Palermo, what you've decided is that you're going to let these hot spots fester to the point where the criminality will metastasize, take over your institutions, infiltrate your police, and then all of us are in danger. So my book is a warning about why we have to care about the kids who can't walk to school safely right now. It's much, much better. It's much better in Watts. It's much better in East L.A. It's much better in the unincorporated areas of Linwood and Maywood.
And you're saying much
it's
better
much
relative.
Safer.
That gang
much
truce
safer.
Was 20 years ago,
that's right.
April. So that was, in some sense, the peak. We're 20 years out. Much improvements. And I do want to talk just a little bit more about
it. It's much better now. But the gap
if we're talking about
is
a system,
huge. The gap is huge between safe communities and the communities where kids still have post-traumatic stress at the levels of our troops. If you take 4,000 children in the kill zones, in the gang zones, and there are about 300,000 children just in the city of L.A. alone who live in gang zones, areas where the parks and the schools and public housing projects are controlled by gangs, and where you can't walk without being stopped by a gang member to say, you're on my turf, where they collect taxes from local businesses. They collect taxes. They take the profit margin from these little mom-and-pop shops, and they put it into their coffers.
So this is what we've seen on The Untouchables or The Godfather.
That's right. That's right. And Southland, the new
yep.
That's actually the best show about LAPD right now. But when you allow these dynamics to fester and grow and get entrenched, they end up spreading to other institutions. That's what Italy did. They assimilated their organized crime. And now they control judges, they control land and title, they control elections. Sicily is completely in the hands of the Italian mob. 10% of Italy's GDP belongs to the organized crime Italian mafia. So we can either go that road and incorporate and assimilate. But see, the problem is once your law enforcement agencies get infiltrated by organized crime, that's the beginning of the end. That's the beginning, not just the road to Palermo, but to what we've spawned in Mexico City with our drug use. We are endangering the sovereign state of Mexico with our drug use because we've empowered these cartels to take over.
You know, one thing I'm thinking of, this is the voice of Connie Rice. We're talking about her work and her book, Power Concedes Nothing. Thomas Barnett, military analyst, I assume you're familiar with him, he talks about, you know, that the threats to the rest of us are the failed states, the gap.
That's right.
And what you're just, and he's talking about, you know, Somalia and the Sudan and so on. That's the same thing going on in our cities, right?
Exactly. That's why General McChrystal and General Holmes and the man I describe in the book as Commander Gann, these military counterinsurgency experts, remember I'm a military kid, they came out here and assessed our
They approached
situation.
You.
They came out here. Yes, they did. They approached me, they approached Chief Bratton, and they approached Sheriff Baca. We invited them out, and they came out here and assessed L.A. The best counterinsurgency strategist in the United States Department of Defense, Petraeus's brain on this stuff, came out here to assess our situation, Terrence. And he told me, sit down, shut up, take out a yellow pad and take notes. He was shaking. He was so angry. He said, I am this country's top counterinsurgency specialist. I've been fighting counterinsurgencies all my life, and whether you agree with me or not, that's my business. If I had had any idea that what I've been fighting all around the globe is here in my backyard, I would never have left. I'd have fought it here. He said, Connie, what you're facing out here is what we in my business call a sustained, incipient, parasitic insurgency. And it is full-blown. They have taken over your prison system. Your prison system is crimogenic. It is connected to your street gangs. We are now being infiltrated by cartels. He said, if you don't get a handle on this, you are creating a transnational threat. And he said, the bad news is that while you have some of the best local police in the world, he said, you have some of the best police in the world I've ever observed. He said, but they are applying elegant tactical responses to a sustained strategic threat, and it cannot work.
So say that one more time.
They are applying elegant tactical responses, meaning keep arresting the same gang members over and over again, whack-a-mole, arrest, arrest, arrest. In prison, in prison, in prison, war on gangs, war on drugs, elegant tactical responses to an enduring strategic threat, and it cannot work. If you do not win these underground populations to your mainstream systems, you will lose your democratic institutions to these crime dynamics. Same thing that he's fighting in Afghanistan. We had better get a clue that we're fighting it here. This has come now from five major top counterinsurgency analysts and every war college. I've been to seven of the war colleges to ask about this. So one lens on this is counterinsurgency. But even the counterinsurgents say it's not about shock and awe.
Right.
Because a war on gangs, Terrence, we've spent $25 billion over 30 years on a war on gangs. We have six times as many gangs and at least twice as many gang members, and those are conservative.
And the numbers overlap, I'm sure, but the war on drugs, very similar.
War on drugs is worse.
Yeah, I think at this point.
We've spent $1 trillion over 35 years, maybe 40 years. Let's be generous. Let's say 40 years, $1 trillion. Drug use has not gone down at all. It's a complete failure.
Right.
And in fact, it has spawned this danger. You got to
remember. That's right. In the old days, it was people helping, you know, helping out the guy in the neighborhood or dealing with.
But we've created. We created the cartels mainly because we did the Medellin, the Cali cartel interdiction. DEA did it so well that they sent the drugs up through Mexico. The Mexican drug runners decided we don't need them. We can do it on our own. And they started taking the drugs for themselves. And once that started, you gave birth to the Mexican cartels, the Zetas and Sinaloa, who are here in L.A. County right now. We gave birth to them, and they are threatening the sovereignty of Mexico because that's how powerful and rich they are. So our drug use has spawned all this. We won't take a look at that. And we're endangering ourselves. We are basically ignoring a cancer that's in our backyard.
Let me do this. Let me give you 3 minutes the last 3 minutes before I close. And what should, I mean, we've talked about events, we've talked about incidents, we've laid it inside a system. What should people be paying attention to, and what should they be doing?
The biggest threats to Los Angeles are as follows. The viability of this region is not attached to neighborhoods like mine. It's not attached to Hollywood. It's not attached to Century City or downtown. That's visible LA. The viability and the sustainability of LA is attached to invisible LA. The communities we can't see, the worlds within worlds we don't know are there, and that are isolated and have been abandoned and have created their own systems of survival. So, number one, we need to face all the dimensions of what isn't here. Because if we don't, we're going to wake up one day and wonder, how did this threat gestate in my own backyard and I didn't know? So we have to win invisible LA and invest in it and nurture it and make it part of our mainstream, or we're going to lose our entire region to the forces that are taking over.
Investment means education, it means training, it means jobs, it means healthcare. What is it?
It means actually understanding the assets that are there with the invisible economy there, because there's a reason we don't have third world poverty exactly. It's because there's such a great underground unregulated economy that we don't understand. And it's about 40% of the mainstream economy is attached to this underground economy. We don't even map it. Let's understand who's here. Let's reach out to them and say, you know, we're not going to have ICE deporting you, but if you're going to be here, we need you to go to school. We need you to participate. We need you to stay. And we've got to make sure that law enforcement, we didn't even talk about the journey with law enforcement.
From the thin blue line to community policing.
Exactly.
I know.
We've got to get that done. And we're still working on that. But, you know, LAPD is my main partner right now. And a lot of my friends say I've gone to the dark side. But I get more done with LAPD than I do with the folks who don't want to deal with them. Bottom line is we have to understand who we are. All of us, invisible LA and visible LA together, number one. And number two, we've got to invest in the systems that build human beings, build communities, build families. We build museums. We build signs. We don't build families. That's the future for LA. So that's what I mean by, you know, we don't need a football stadium. We need an after-school care network. We need health care for the kids so they have glasses when they go and can see the blackboard.
And dental care.
And dental care. And we need kids who can actually see a future for themselves other than joining a gang. So we need the cops to keep going down the road that they're going. I've got to focus on the sheriffs now, and I'm scared to death that they might not be helpable. I've got to figure out how to help them get up on the right footing. LAPD is on the right road. The leadership is there. I'm not going to say that the street cops are all there yet, but we need another 5 years of Beck, and I think we'll be on the road. But just understand these problems at a depth and level that very few people do, number one. Number two, force your politicians to take some tough votes to make sure that invisible LA isn't left out, that we don't, at the expense of poor LA, take more for the advantaged communities. More, we've got to understand that when we insist on, for example, $14 million for false home alarm systems, when the police have to respond to them, that $14 million doesn't go to solve the 6,000 unsolved murders in South LA. And we need to tell our West Side representatives, we don't want that money to go to us. Bill Bratton needs it for South LA and East LA. That's the kind of advocacy we're going to have to do, or we're not going to make it.
Okay, we got to close it there. The book is Power Concedes Nothing, One Woman's Quest for Social Justice in America from the Courtroom to the Kill Zones. And as Connie Rice just said, we skipped, I mean, the whole, you know, her investigation of Rampart, her recommendations that were adopted by the police, her work now within the police, but we did it so we could talk about the system in the future. You can listen to this week's conversation and many others anytime during the week by linking to our podcast. You can sign up to have it delivered to you weekly. For podcasts, articles, transcripts, to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net. Or aworldatjustmightwork.com. They're the same website. You can get the podcast there or at iTunes. You can sign up there at iTunes to get it delivered to you weekly. You can sign up there or by emailing me at T.E. McNally, T.E. McNally at mac.com. I send out a weekly announcement. I'll tell you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, and usually two or three articles. Thanks to G, my engineer, Stan Mizrahi, and Mark Maxwell in production, Matt Perez in traffic, and to you, my listeners. I look forward to being with you again next week. And finally, thank you to Connie Rice. Keep up the good work.
Thank you.